A User's Guide to Overthrowing Dictatorships, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The late political theorist Gene Sharp inspired pro-democracy activists all around the globe. This former activist in Serbia remembers one of Sharp's important lessons about the value of nonviolence.
Why would you challenge your opponent where he's strong and you are weak? Wouldn't you rather challenge Mike Tyson on the field of Scrabble as opposed to the boxing ring?
Plus, two women adopted as teenagers returned to the group home in China where they lived before coming to the U.S.
Abigail and I got very emotional, and, you know, when I saw one of the young adults, I just pretty much cried.
Plus, orcas that sound like humans.
Hello!
Well, sorta. That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Good to have you here today. So what if writing a pamphlet could change the world? Gene Sharp tried it. Sharp was a soft-spoken Boston political theorist who died this week. He wrote a celebrated guide, a manual, really, for overthrowing dictatorships. From Dictatorship to Democracy, a Conceptual Framework for Liberation, was published in 1994 and offered tactics and theories that helped activists challenge authoritarian leaders from Burma to Bosnia to Syria.
This is one of the books that gives nightmares to dictators across the world.
That's Serge Popovic, one of the founders of the Serbian pro-democracy group, Otpor. He now directs the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies. And Popovic says Sharp offered activists a realistic alternative to violent conflict.
His books were translated into 27 different languages. Moreover, and more important, they were implemented by amazing movements from Venezuela to Zimbabwe, from Eastern Europe all the way to Burma. And they were also hated by some of the worst guys in the world who were really upset with the fact that Gene's idea were finding a fertile ground within their own population. He was nominated for Nobel Peace Prize, but moreover, he was a great inspiration, the very modest person and a dear friend to me.
So how would you sum up Gene Sharp's central message about power and the power of dictatorship?
Gene Sharp's central idea is that people have the power and the rulers have the power, only that power that people provides them. And if people mobilize and organize to deny power to the ruler, then the complete power structure changes. Also, he emphasized the importance of the three most important principles of nonviolent struggle: unity. How do you build political unity? You must have a strategic and tactical planning. And last but not least importance, nonviolent discipline.
So just for another taste of what Gene Sharp was like as a person, I'd like us to hear an excerpt from a documentary called How to Start a Revolution from a filmmaker, Rory Arrow. Here's an excerpt from that doc. It's Gene Sharp giving a lecture at Harvard University in the 1970s.
I say nonviolent struggle is armed struggle. Only with this type of struggle, one fights with psychological weapons, social weapons, economic weapons, and political weapons. And that this is ultimately more powerful against oppression, injustice, and tyranny than is violence.
So, Serge Popovic, nonviolence was kind of a pragmatic choice for Gene Sharp, not an ethical choice, right?
Nonviolence was not a religious or ethical choice, but not only that the nonviolence is far more ethical than the violence, it is proven that it's far more likely to succeed. There are several reasons for this. First of all, when you are addressing the pillars of an autocratic state, it is them who have the monopoly on violence, and it is them who has the advantage. And following the principles of Sun Tzu, Sharp's teachings were going into why would you challenge your opponent where he is strong and you are weak? Wouldn't you rather challenge Mike Tyson on the field of Scrabble as opposed to the boxing ring? The way the nonviolent struggle wins is by mobilizing the majority of the people. In Serbian struggle, which was the struggle against the dictator Slobodan Milosevic, which had the center of it in the free and fair elections, it was the people who mobilized around the election fraud. And of course, once the victory was achieved through defending the democratic institution of the free and fair elections, it is very difficult to take this victory out of the people because you have millions of shareholders of this change.
We should say, though, that the tactics Sharp advocated often failed miserably and people died as a result. Let's listen to another excerpt from the film How to Start a Revolution, where Gene Sharp talks about the protesters in Tiananmen Square in 1989.
They were not prepared. There was no strategic decision. There was no advanced decision how long you stay in the square and when you leave. What became very clear to me in retrospect was that the students in the square were operating with great commitment and bravery, but they really didn't know what the hell they were doing.
Serge, did you ever see Gene Sharp's tactics backfire on the ground in Serbia?
Well, this is not like Gene Sharp had advised one tactic. In fact, the beauty of Gene's work is that telling you that the nonviolent struggle is far more than protesting, marching, and what we call in our Canvas teaching the tactics of concentration. You have more than 200 different tactics listed by Gene Sharp that you can use. And you don't start by using a tactic. You start by seeing and envisioning the change. And then, as Gene said, building the strategy. And then within this strategy, you are taking a look at the tactic that will work. For a highly oppressive regime like China in 1989, it was not the public gathering that I would kind of advise. You would take a look at the low-risk tactics. You would take a look at hitting pots and pans, wearing symbols, doing strikes, boycotts, petition. And there are so many different things you can do. From a strategic level, one of the amazing things that that Gene outlined in his work is that your strategy must consist on the small victories. These small victories should be small, achievable, tangible things. And it is very important that you know when and how to proclaim the victory and get the hell out of there. And this is exactly what was missing in the case of the Tiananmen.
So you said people who were reading Gene Sharp's book, Scared Dictators. And when Gene Sharp was abroad, he was often accused of fronting for the CIA, right?
Iran 2009 was an extreme example. The regime produced a cartoon video portraying Gene sitting with the Vice President Dick Cheney in a room and plotting the revolution in Iran.
Wow.
Of course, these regimes desperately need to say these revolutions are coming from abroad, they are not domestic, because they're treating their people as the sheep. They don't assume that their people see the misery, see the injustice, and seek democracy. And if some of the people do, it's probably because somebody is paying them from abroad. It is the people talent on the ground. It is the people understanding the situation. This is not something you can get from the book or get from the foreigners. So you need to equip yourself with the skills. But the hard work of changing your society is always in the hands of the brave citizens of the society or the community.
Serge Popovic, founder of the Serbian pro-democracy group Otpar, helping us look back on the life of author Gene Sharp. Serge, thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure.
Gene Sharp has also been credited with influencing the uprisings of the 2011 Arab Spring. But take Tunisia out of the equation, and it's hard to see much progress in the Arab Spring countries toward democracy. Not in Syria or Yemen. And in Egypt this week, President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi warned that what happened in 2011 will not happen again. Sisi is running for re-election next month, and most of his political rivals have either been jailed or pushed aside. Heba Morayef is Egyptian and a longtime human rights activist. She's with Amnesty International. Morayef says things were bad under the previous rule of Hosni Mubarak, but they're even worse now.
The scale of enforced disappearances, the number of journalists who are in Egyptian prisons, the number of the founders of the human rights community who have been banned from travel, reprisals against prisoners. The general human rights situation is not one which allows for an environment where the political opposition can operate.
Just elaborate on human rights under Sisi. How bad is it?
Well, President Mubarak's policy towards the opposition, which he never took seriously, was to leave them a margin in which they could operate. He allowed the Muslim Brotherhood to operate, only rounding them up ahead of parliamentary elections. He allowed human rights organizations to function. He allowed leftist political parties to hold press conferences. That margin of space, of course, is what eventually built up towards the 2011 uprising. And I think President Sisi's entire approach has been to prevent even that small space from existing, or the idea of space. What we heard in Sisi's last speech was very, very dire warnings against the enemies of Egypt, against anyone who might think to try to repeat what happened 7 or 8 years ago. He kept saying, I will not allow this to happen again, basically ascribing the uprising to the interference by forces who are enemies of Egypt. And that's the fundamental problem, is that Sisi never saw the 2011 uprising as a natural event, as an organic expression of rage by a younger generation that felt abandoned by its government. He believed it was a conspiracy. And so all of what he's done over the last 4 years in terms of having a zero tolerance approach towards the idea of politics itself has been designed to kill any idea that there might be space for opposition politics.
Is he courting another uprising, or is that precisely what he's doing to basically make sure another one doesn't happen?
Well, fear is a very powerful factor. In 2011, we Egyptians used to say that we'd lost our fear and it would never come back, but that's not true. Fear has returned. The other factor is that a lot of the people who participated in the uprising did so because they were suffering socioeconomically and because of their social justice demands. And they've seen how life has become a lot harder since 2011 uprising. Things have become much more expensive with the devaluation of the pound. Inflation has spiked. Hardship has increased. So the uprising hasn't really translated into the desired social justice. And I doubt that right now in this environment, we would see people instinctively going towards that in the hope of improving their livelihoods.
In 2011, President Obama was essentially telling Egyptians in the street not to be fearful. Why do you think the U.S. has not been critical of what's happening now in Egypt?
Well, I think President Sisi took a lot of comfort from the warm embrace he received from President Trump. That is quite significant. He, to the eyes of his Western allies, whether in the U.S. or Europe, has stabilized Egypt in a very unstable region. And if the price of stability is sacrificing human rights, then from what we can tell right now, from the way Western powers have reacted towards Egypt, that's a price they're very willing to turn a blind eye to. And the U.S. is obviously is the major supporter of the Egyptian military. And so what President Trump, I think, wants to see in Egypt right now is a stable Egypt where human rights are not really a factor at all in the equation.
And how much would it matter if the Trump administration was calling on President Sisi to respect human rights and democracy?
You know, it would matter greatly. They still care a great deal about what the U.S. government says. That's still an incredibly important relationship.
Heba Moraev of Amnesty International joining us from London. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll have this story for you. A Palestinian-American artist living in the West Bank who started a public effort to get Palestinian women to talk about their experiences with sexual harassment and assault. Hashtag not your Habibti means I'm not your sweetheart. But artist Yasmin Mjali says not all Palestinians welcome the effort.
I've had women themselves come up to me and say that you should not be trying to tackle gender-based issues. We have an occupation to be dealing with. So I receive flack for, I guess, maybe ignoring what others see as the larger issue. And I do as well, because to deviate from the norm and to call attention to what are these subliminal social issues dubs me as a bad girl of the Arab world.
More of my conversation with artist and activist Yasmin Mjali, that's tomorrow here on the show. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. A military standoff in Yemen is keeping some people up at night.
Colleagues at work ask me, what's going on with you? Are you getting any sleep?
This lab technician in Michigan does not want to miss a thing.
I slept 2 hours and I drank 20 ounces of coffee. I'll be okay.
We'll learn why she's losing sleep over Yemen in just a minute. First, though, let's go to journalist Iona Craig, who's been following events there. So the reason we called you today was to ask about events in southern Yemen. There was a big rally in the port city of Aden. It turned deadly on Sunday. Then we heard reports that fighters for a southern separatist movement, as in militants who want to divide the country in two apparently, had taken control of government buildings there. So for those of us who did not even know there was a separatist movement in Yemen, quickly bring us up to speed on that.
Well, before 1990, Yemen was two separate states. You had the northern Yemen and then you had southern Yemen, and they were unified in 1990, but then there was a civil war in 1994. So this is something of a revolving history, if you like. The separatist movement really grew from 2007, the southern movement, as they were known then, or Hirak, as they're called in Yemen. And that was a political movement, a peaceful political movement, that was calling for at least some form of autonomy from northern rule. Some were even calling for secession from the north. But that really changed with the onset of this conflict in 2015. Many of the southern separatists really see this as a fight between north and south. That's largely now down to the fact that the front lines have kind of gone back to the old borderlines of what was previously north and south Yemen. But of course, they are an armed group now. They were central to the fighting in Aden back in 2015. They were the ones that were really responsible for liberating the city from the Houthi Saleh forces then. And so they hold a lot more power than they had previously done. And they have been very heavily supported as well by the United Arab Emirates in their efforts. And they're really key to what's happening now in Aden over the last few days, because really the Southern Transitional Council, that they now call themselves, wouldn't really be able to exist without the support of the UAE.
And what do the separatists want?
What they've been calling for over the last few weeks, and certainly they gave the Hadi government a 1 week deadline, was for the removal of his government and a replacement of them, that they can then obviously have an influence in choosing the ministers and the members of that government.
It sounds like these separatists have some really long-standing grievances.
Absolutely. The biggest issues facing Yemen, even before this war started and even preceding the Arab Spring of 2011, was always issues over marginalization all the way around the country. And that really manifested in the north in the form of the Houthi movement and in the south as the southern separatists. And those issues clearly haven't gone away. They are the base of this conflict at the moment.
So if these separatists are successful, let me be somewhat charitable here. Are two Yemens a solution to the war? Like, is it possible at some future point there could be a North Yemen and South Yemen again, and that would lead to peace?
In the future, I think anything is possible. Part of the separatist course, I met with Aida Rous al-Zubaydi several times.
Remind us who he is.
He is the leader of the Southern Transitional Council, who's been leading this fight in Aden.
Right.
And they've talked about a referendum to decide the southerners' fate so that they can have a referendum over southern independence. But generally, the international community and Saudi Arabia is not in favor of separation again. You have to remember, going back to the beginning of this conflict back in 2014, one of the bubbling problems in Yemen, which was never resolved, was the issue of federalism. So perhaps a halfway measure is some form of federalism in the future, with possibly autonomy after that. Some of the Southern Transitional Council members, they do want full separation. Other separatists are less hardline and would rather have some form of autonomy.
Journalist Iona Craig there. For some people, events in Yemen hit very close to home. And by home, I mean Michigan. Samer Ahmed is a lab technician living outside Dearborn. She's also a spokesperson for the Southern Transitional Council, which you just heard about.
I wake up in the morning and the first thing I have to do is watch the news, read the news, see, you know, any updates, and call family over there, check if they're okay, you know, is anybody hurt?
Ahmed is one of our go-to people for understanding the complexities of the Yemen conflict.
I'm probably the one that pops up the most because I'm probably the loudest. For us, it's very important to communicate the situation in South Yemen in English and the suffering of the people, because many don't know what's happening there.
What's happening now, she says, is seen by many people as a culmination of decades of mistreatment of people in southern Yemen by the central government in the north.
Well, the number one thing is almost every house in South Yemen has lost someone. A family member has been killed or imprisoned by the government in Sana'a.
Ahmed was born in Aden. Her parents brought her to the U.S. just as southern Yemen was being merged with northern Yemen. It was an era marked by violence and abuses.
It was 1994, I think. I was sitting there watching TV with my dad. It was the Arabic channel from the Middle East. I used to wake up in the morning and my dad is sitting there watching the events unfold and get ready for school. I'd go to school and then come home running. And then me and my dad would sit there and watch what's happening. So I was young. I think I was 12 years old at that time.
Today, Ahmed uses Twitter to get out news about South Yemen to thousands of people, but some of her most important followers aren't on Twitter.
My mom is a person who worries a lot. I love my mom, but it's because she's lived through so many wars. She's always scared and terrified if things go out of control. I'll make calls and calm her down. Things will be okay. It's okay, you know. The Southern Resistance Forces are in control of everything. And don't worry, no one will be tortured or imprisoned. My dad is a very quiet man. He sits, he watches, doesn't say much. He'll say, don't worry, they'll be okay. Don't worry about them. You know, they're men. They'll take care of everything. That's what my dad will say.
Samer Ahmed, spokesperson for Yemen's Southern Transitional Council. She lives outside Dearborn, Michigan. Let's follow up on a story we told you about yesterday, Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, for Syrians. Amr Sina is Syrian and joined us on the show. He's been living in Watertown, Massachusetts, for the past few years, working as a software engineer. And he was granted TPS because of the ongoing conflict back home in Syria. It's allowed him to live and work legally here in the U.S., but TPS has to be renewed every 18 months. And yesterday was the day Amr and almost 7,000 other Syrians with TPS were waiting to hear whether their status would expire or be extended by the White House. I asked Amr what would happen if it wasn't renewed and he had to go back to Syria.
Sending me back to Syria means death for me because of my political opinion against the regime there. So I've been on the news all the time, trying just watching news, trying to see if the decision is out, but it's still not out yet.
The news finally came around 8 p.m. last night. TPS was extended. Amr can breathe easier for now. In 18 months, though, he and other Syrians will be waiting anxiously once again. I'm Marco Werman. A fourth-generation Chinese-American travels to his ancestral village in China and meets a distant relative.
He's beaming. He's smiling and he's shaking my hand. And I said, what is he saying? And the interpreter turned to me and she said, he just told me you're the first person to ever return to the village from America.
The whole story still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. When it comes to immigration, the Trump administration has made one thing very clear. The number of people who come to this country legally needs to go down. And one way Trump has proposed doing that is by changing family reunification rules. Those rules currently allow immigrants who are already in the U.S. legally to sponsor family members who want to join them here. As Trump steers immigration policy away from family reunion, some are looking at the Chinese Exclusion Act as a reminder of the human cost of keeping families apart. The law was enacted at the end of the 19th century, shutting the door to basically all new immigrants from China.
The Chinese Exclusion Act affected my family by tearing them apart to the point they were never able to go home, never able to reconnect.
That's Russell Lowe, a doctor in San Diego. His family emigrated to the U.S. in the 1800s. When the Chinese Exclusion Act came around, his family members in the U.S. stayed put, fearing that if they went back to China to visit, they wouldn't be able to come back to the U.S. And Lowe's relatives back home were, of course, barred from coming to this country. Lowe recently embarked on a journey to find out more about how the law impacted his family.
I grew up in California. I'm a fourth-generation Chinese. Now, my father-in-law says it takes three generations to make an American, and as a fourth generation, I felt American. And it wasn't really probably until my son was born 35 years ago that I began to explore our Chinese history to try to make him a family tree. And I could initially look very easily at those who are in America, my more immediate family, of course, and my grandparents, but trying to find out something about those in China was almost impossible. There were no records. And nobody knew much.
But you managed to trace your family's roots to a couple of villages in southern China, and you went there in 2016. Tell us what you learned about how the Chinese Exclusion Act impacted your family.
Well, I did make this journey finally to Dailong Village, which is in Toishan, one of the four counties just west of Hong Kong. And I walked into this home that my great-grandfather was born in. It was really humbling. But when I talked to the village elders, there was an Uncle Hong there. And all the Chinese were in this room speaking Chinese, which I don't understand. And they're arguing very in a very animated fashion about who these families were, who the relatives were. And at one point, he grabs my hand. He's beaming. He's smiling and he's shaking my hand. And I said, "What is he saying?" And the interpreter turned to me and she said, "He just told me you're the first person to ever return to the village from America."
Wow.
It was humbling. And then I asked him later, said, "Well, my great-grandfather, Hung Lai Wo, had four other brothers. How many of them went to America?" And he said, "They all went to America," which we didn't know. And my next question was, "What happened to them?" And what he replied was really striking. He said, "We have no idea."
Wow.
In another village I went to, which was my grandfather's village, it's the low side of the family, they said, "Well, he never came home." So the loss of connection between the home village and the people who immigrated to America was complete. It was absolute.
Wow. The Chinese Exclusion Act, it was really the first major law restricting immigration to the U.S. Do you see a common denominator between what is motivating efforts to curb legal immigration today and efforts that happened during the Exclusion Act period?
Well, certainly in the Exclusion Act period, the Chinese were blamed for all of the economic problems that were overtaking America and California at that time. And it wasn't just economic, however. There was a lot of racism involved. The Chinese were cast as being subhuman. They were the yellow peril, the dirty, diseased, immoral. The truth was the opposite. Now, if you look at the situation today, I think that we have the same climate of fear and racism and hatred that we had 135 years ago with the Chinese Exclusion Act. We believe immigrants are stealing jobs. They're stealing our sense of security and our self-respect, but I think that's absolutely not true. And if you look at the contributions of my immigrant family and sort of fast forward 150 years ago, we have now over 100 descendants in this country. And in this group, there are doctors and nurses, teachers, psychologists, neuroscientists, war heroes. There's even an F-15 fighter pilot. And had my grandparents given in, had they gone back to the villages, America would be suffering for it.
So I'd really love to know your visit back to China in 2016. Would you describe your visit as one of reunification with your family, but severely delayed?
I think it was a time of celebration and reunification, albeit brief, really not just for myself, but really for the people in the family in these villages. One of the things that I often say about this story is that my whole life, I've been told that I don't look like I'm Chinese, and I never quite understood. It was the same for my father. We just didn't look like the people around us. And it was true in China. I went to China, and they said, "You know, Russell, you don't look like you're Chinese. We think you're something else." And so I stood on a street corner in Beijing and looked at thousands of people, and they were right. But when I went to this second village, my grandfather's village, the low village, I got out of the car, and I looked at the people, and they all looked like me. It's just absolutely stunning. And at that moment, I realized, you know, where I came from.
That must have been some kind of closure for you, I would think.
It was absolutely stunning. It was just a moment where I had thought that I was going back to learn about my grandfather who left there in 1877. And instead, I really learned about myself.
What did you learn? Like, what is the main thing you learned about yourself?
I learned where I'm from. I learned where the genetic material came from. And I think that that's really a story that plays out across many different immigrants in America today. You know, in this country, we all have similar pasts that sometimes are lost. And not just for the Chinese, but I think for a lot of Americans, you lose that connection to your roots. And it's really, really important to understand where they came from, to understand how you came to be here. Because I firmly believe that these immigrants who struggled in the 1800s and 1900s to come to this country were bringing themselves and their genes to America, and our children, our grandchildren, really are the result of that sacrifice.
Russell Lowe telling us about how his family was affected by the Chinese Exclusion Act. If you want more on the Chinese Exclusion Act and to see photos of Russell Lowe's trip to China, come over to PRI.org. Russell, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This next story from our Across Women's Lives desk is also about returning to China. So let me tell you the story of Bingye Turner and Abigail Anderson, who were orphans in China. They were both 13 when they were adopted and brought to their new homes here in the United States. Bingye was adopted by a family in Washington State, Abigail by a family in Virginia. And last year, they both returned to Qinghai Province and the children's home where they lived before adoption. It was part of an effort called Back to Serve, a program set up by the charity that operates the orphanage as a way to encourage former residents to return to China to reconnect. Bingye joins us now from Seattle and Abigail from Smithfield, Virginia. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So as you look back on it, I'll start with you, Bingye. Give us a quick takeaway. How did it feel going back?
It was exciting at first, but then, you know, as time gone by, all the memories hit back to me. Because when I was little, I pretty much lived with a family. At that time, it was just me and my dad. And then those are all the good memories. Then all the bad memories came back because my dad passed away when I was 10 years old. So it was just very conflicting and then confusing.
Mm. What about you, Abigail?
For me, it's definitely a roller coaster ride because I went back. My surrogate grandmother is getting in her golden age, I guess you could say. And I'm really thankful that she is still alive and well.
Mm.
But also just being in that environment again is definitely a lot to take in because after I got adopted, we don't really talk about the past at all. So everything hit you pretty hard.
So, Bingye, let me ask you about the children who were at the orphanage with you when you were there as orphans. I mean, the ones who were not adopted. What was that like? Did you see them again?
We did, actually. They're being left behind pretty much with disabilities. And then when they age out of children's home, they're going to the Social Welfare Institute.
I mean, these kids who were not adopted, known as the left behinds, kind of a sad term. I'm just curious, what did you talk about?
They asked us about our life in U.S. And then they were just curious about how we were, like, do we get along with our families? At first, when we were there, they were shocked.
What were they shocked by?
They were pretty much shocked by we were actually there. Abigail and I got very emotional. And, you know, when I saw one of the young adults, his name is Bing Bing. And then I just pretty much cried. I've known that, like, he went through 10 major surgeries. Yeah. But then I still recognized him since I pretty much, like, took care of him when he was little. What about you, Abigail?
We were just trying to reconnect with them. And also, for them to able to have someone to really pour their hearts out without worrying about anything else. So it's just great.
Did it mean, though, that maybe you weren't able to speak as freely as you wanted? Maybe you censored yourself to not kind of show what a great life you have in the U.S., if that is indeed the case? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Because they're still at the orphanage. And we tell them, no matter where you are, there's always challenges you have to face and overcome that.
Bingye, you and Abigail, you first met at the orphanage. Tell us about that. Were you, like, instant friends?
No. This is Abby, no. First time I saw them was, I think it was elementary school. And I saw this new girl. She's wearing blue with a white striped school uniform and with white scarves.
Wow, what a great memory.
I just thought she was a visitor. So I didn't really think much about it until later on. I said, no. She's going to be one of your sisters.
How long had you been at the orphanage when Bingye arrived?
I was there since infancy, before the orphanage actually opened.
So you were both a little older, I mean, as I said, 13, than the babies who are often adopted. At any point, did you both start to wonder if you might end up being left behind?
Yes, actually. In the beginning, we didn't know about the age limit for international adoption in China, which is 14. For me, especially, it's cutting super close. I got adopted when I was only like 2 weeks shy from turning 14.
Hmm.
So all the agencies rushing everything. So it was a miracle that I actually got adopted.
Did you have any of those thoughts, Bingye? I mean, I know you got to the orphanage after your father died, so you were older, obviously. But did you wonder, how long am I going to be here?
Yeah, because I went to the orphanage when I was 11 years old. You know, on the first day when I saw Abigail and then the rest of the school-age kids, definitely it was a life-changing for me. for a minute, and I thought it would be cool to have like sisters and brothers, because I was the only child when I lived with my father. But then after a month or so, then the reality hit me, and I realized that I had no one to talk to. I had just like kept everything to myself. So the first time I saw a toddler got adopted by like American family, I didn't think of much because I know that like I'm older, so I never thought of like I would get adopted. Till Abigail got adopted first, so which is so not fair. That's what I thought. And then 10 months later, I got adopted.
Abigail, what is the one thing you took away from your visit back to Qinghai province?
Definitely closure and personal growth. I'm able to be more open about my past. Just accept that as part of me.
Benjie, what about you?
I developed a lot skill-wise. And then growth-wise, I think I'm still like processing like what happened when I was in China. I finally found myself, because before then, I lived in a wonderful family, and then I was just the average American girl with dreams. And I never thought of like, you know, going back to China to do the volunteer work. And I found that I had a missing piece in me, and then now I found it.
What a great way of expressing it, a missing piece that you found. One thing that I haven't asked you is how close have you both stayed in touch here in the States since you were both adopted? And did this visit back to China make the bond between you even stronger?
This is Abby.
Abby, go first.
Okay, Abby, go. You go first.
So, I think it definitely strengthens our bond because during challenging time, we're able to support each other, not just being physical there, but emotionally being a supporter of each other.
Yeah, because luckily that Abigail's parents and my parents decided that it's okay for us to communicate with each other and support each other, like emotional support.
So not sisters at birth, but sisters forever?
Yes.
Yes.
Benjie Turner in Seattle and Abigail Anderson in Smithfield, Virginia. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
You can see photos of Benjie and Abigail's trip to China. We've got those at PRI.org. Earlier on the show, we were talking about the run-up to the presidential election in Egypt. A lot of candidates have been blocked from running. In Kenya, it's the aftermath of elections that's causing problems. Opposition leader Raila Odinga is disputing the victory of incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta. Odinga went so far as to just inaugurate himself earlier this week. It meant nothing, but still the government was not happy and even shut down media outlets that covered it. Today, a Kenyan court told the government to allow those media outlets to reopen. Reporter Wairimu Gitahi is in the capital, Nairobi. I mean, we're talking major newspapers and TV channels. Everything is back open now?
No, actually, the TV channels are not yet back. There are no signs from the government on when they will be back on air.
The newspaper, The Nation, for example, it sounded really kind of crazy with the military surrounding the building. I mean, can you give us just describe what happened?
Yes. At least one of the journalists who is an editor at Nation said that from reliable sources, he got to know that there were police officers surrounding the building, and the aim was to arrest some of them from that television station called Nation TV. He says that he stayed in the office for a long time because he was afraid that he would be arrested.
But today, newspapers are publishing?
Yes, newspapers were not have been circulating. It's only the TV stations.
So back to the source of all this, why is opposition leader Raila Odinga claiming still he won the election?
He says that he won the elections because he says that it's very clear there were many illegalities. The process was corrupt. And also the people who are conducting the elections did not conduct them according to what the court had ruled before. And at the same time, it is seen taking this oath is seen as a direct challenge to Uhuru Kenyatta's presidency, even though it was a symbolic oath.
I mean, shutting down the media for covering a story seems extreme. How worried are Kenyans that this is emblematic of democracy in their country under President Uhuru Kenyatta? And maybe Raila Odinga has a point.
Yeah, you see, there have been quite some fierce criticism, and some people also don't mind. The thing that one has to understand here is that Uhuru Kenyatta has a large following, but so does Raila. So what does that mean? When the government does something, the views are more or less like divided. There are those who think this is taking us back to those days of the President Daniel Arap Moi, who was a dictator. There are those who are saying, no, these guys, Raila swearing himself in, means that he was trying to, you know, take over from the president. And so, I mean, the views are quite different depending on whether you are supporting Raila or whether you are supporting Uhuru Kenyatta.
Partisanship sounds very familiar. Journalist Wairimu Gitahi in Nairobi, Kenya. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
And finally, learning another language can be difficult, but learning how to say hello in the language of another species, well, that's a much different challenge.
Hello. Hello. Hello.
The response there to the hello is an orca. Yeah, an orca. And now a new scientific study has shown that some of them do have the ability to imitate or even say human words. Joseph Call is a professor in evolutionary origins of the mind at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland and is a co-author of the study. So what is it that you found exactly, Joseph?
We wanted to explore the abilities of the orca to copy new sounds. And one thing that we thought is we could try sounds that orcas themselves produce, but what would be a really impressive demonstration of vocal copying abilities is they could copy the sounds of another species. And in this case, we chose humans, and we chose in particular words to see whether they would copy them. And this is the result, what your listeners just heard.
Did you try any other species with orcas to see how they might copy them?
In mammals, the ability to copy new sounds is quite restricted. Humans are very good at it, but terrestrial mammals are not very good at it. The ones that are better, actually, are the marine mammals. So you have some work with dolphins and with belugas, and in this study, we tried with the orca.
So what is it about orcas, you think, that give them this ability to that other animals don't have?
One thing that is noticeable in orcas already in the wild is that they have different dialects. They're species-specific vocalizations. Different groups of orcas, they have different dialects.
Wow.
You can distinguish them by those vocalizations. So that already gives you a clue that this variation in vocal production may have something to do with their great ability to learn new vocalizations.
So imitating sounds, that's one thing, but understanding words is obviously another. Is there any way to know whether an orca like Wilkie can understand that hello is a greeting?
I would not go that far. I think our study was focused on simply would they recognize and would they produce new sounds. And that we were able to demonstrate whether Wilkie understands the meaning of hello. We absolutely have no idea. There is actually no evidence that we know that this is the case. This, I would say, is a different study. It's not the question that we were pursuing.
Let's listen to a longer clip of the speech imitations. This is more of the trainer and orca, I guess you could say, in conversation.
One, two, three. One, two, three.
Wow, okay, I got the two and the three there. what purpose might this skill have in the wild for orcas? Like, do orcas use sound to communicate in the ocean?
Yes, they do. And they also use sound to hunt and also to communicate with conspecifics, yes. One thing that is interesting here, if the last one that you played, you see the accuracy is not that great. The sound is not something that one would recognize as a one or a two or a three. Now, one thing to keep in mind is that the orca is producing these sounds in air. Orcas normally produce sounds underwater.
Of course.
And she's using a completely different morphology to produce sounds that we can recognize as human words. And the orca is doing that with a completely different morphology. And I think that that is something that is quite remarkable.
Joseph Call at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, thanks very much for telling us about the study. It's fascinating.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And that's where we leave things today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.